Welcome to Star Drifter, the science fiction audiobook series written and read by David Collins Rivera. Today's story, All He Surveys, Volume 1, Chapter 4. With Dinar being situated at the jump point, there was basically no travel time in real space in order to leave. In other star systems that had stations deep in a stellar gravity well, it could take hours, days, or even weeks to get to a jump point. But here, it was only a matter of inputting the right ejection cue to nav, which was supplied by orbital control on the station. We waited our turn, then moved off from Dinar's general proximity. An hour later, we were clear of this assigned taxi vector and were given the final okay to exit the universe. Poof! Star jump. Dorcas of the Heather's pre-transitional sequence only applied when exiting a pocket dimension of jump space, so there was nary a rattled pan to mark the transition. That collapsing down feeling in the pit of my stomach still happened, but after all these years, it was a source of comfort. Indeed, it was a hallmark of the one thing in life that I never regretted doing. With our jump came a full return to work. I wasn't on shift when we left Far London system, but that sort of thing seemed to have little meaning in the culinary field. Honestly, though the kitchen roster had been posted for all to see, no one seemed to pay it any heed. As a species, cooks appeared to be restless, working, always working. They'd roil, argue, and throw pans, but they worked. Most came on duty and left to pass out for a shift, or part thereof, with no other consideration but the requirements of the moment, or perhaps the dinner service ahead. Chef Irina and Timot had to cover long hours, too, and were essentially management on top of that, so the rest of us just focused on whatever it took to keep the kitchen running smoothly and see that people were being fed. And all of that was going sideways, at least such was the pervasive fear. A new chef, however temporary. He was not only covering his employees, but all the passengers and crew. Could it be done? Were we up to the task of helping this man the way he would need? Was he up to the task at all? It seemed like a lot to ask of everyone. I'd seen what Irina Markoviskov could do, both with food and with her people, and it had both impressed and intimidated me. That was nothing special, certainly, since I knew nothing to begin with and was easily awed. Chef Tonva was going to have to impress fellow professionals, and having seen them in action, I wondered how that was possible. Within this pocket existence, there was only work and sleep and work and sleep, and sometimes, as a change of pace, experimentation with new food. On that front, we were all learning. Tonva turned out to be a highly disciplined but jolly sort of guy in his way. He rarely smiled, but often seemed amused by things we took for granted. Several kitchen gadgets were apparently new to him, while his people had unpacked implements and devices that even Timot couldn't, at first glance, account for. And the older, rotund man seemed positively perplexed by the sous vide process. This on its own was a mystery, considering how old and intrinsic it was to most cookery. But as I say, these were impressions. It was just as possible he was amused by nothing, confused by nothing, and that ours was but one of a long line of kitchens that didn't know what to make of him, his requirements, and his predilections. So it was as off-putting and alien an experience as I'd been anticipating, but it was also far less stressful than it could have been, indeed as it probably should have been, all things considered. If this were common practice for them, then the fussy Fousals, who apparently had to have their own way, even in a place like the galley where they would never set foot, provided Zeeplin Thonva with ample experience in dealing with people who resented his very presence. There was no real upheaval in the galley as a result. The place was rather sedate, and this in a galley where discipline was already instilled. Even Yuku stopped nettling me all the time, testament to a quiet control expressed through nothing more complicated than his expectations of us. I found this management style fascinating to watch, like a circus act. Something beautiful, but hard to follow and utterly impossible for me personally to ever replicate. I said we never saw the passengers, but actually it was policy to serve them in their cabins if they requested it. Part of what made the cruise so special was the actual experience of it, including the fancy restaurant, so people tended not to make regular use of room service. But if they were feeling poorly or were not in the mood to dress up or didn't want to deal with an audience on a given day, because another thing they were paying for, of course, was the drama of each other's company, they'd call the steward for a meal who would, in turn, call the kitchen. When a notice of delivery was submitted, an auto trolley was dispatched with generous portions of whatever was asked for, assuming such a meal, or a facsimile, could be crafted in a reasonable amount of time. On other passenger ships I'd worked, the trolleys were sent off on their own, since they were really just robots with navigation and collision sensors. On this vessel, however, one or more members of the steward's team, or if they were swamped, the wait or kitchen staff, were sent along with the machine. These crew members were then required to stand by, serve, or otherwise attend to the passengers as required, so that a full service experience could be had even under such personal circumstances. Early in the cruise, I'd followed the trolley down one of the wide companionways over to the Ruby class suites, whereupon I rang a bell outside a set of gold filigreed double doors. They were promptly opened by a personal manservant dressed in a flamboyant, lacy uniform of rich lavender, and I turned the trolley over to him. I was then asked to remain outside and did so, feeling impatient and stupid standing there like a derelict on a street corner. Passengers that went by didn't see me at all. Servants standing around waiting to be needed were simply part and parcel of their lives. After an hour with my feet hurting, the same guy in the expensive clown suit shooed the robot outside and passed this operation back with a sharp nod. Taken as a whole, it was a nothing experience that spoke volumes about everyone involved, including me. On the first day of the star jump from Dinar Station, an hour off from the serving of the midshift meal, or dinner, as some called it, Chef Thonva got a call on his personal comm. It was short and seemed to hold no surprises, but he waved over Linesman Duca and spoke with him in that strange nasal tongue from a far-off world. The young man nodded, then went into the dining room, apparently in search of someone in particular. This must have been fruitless, because he returned after a moment, looking balked or concerned. He then studied the galley, settled his troubled gaze on the apprenti, and hooked a finger to bring me over.
"Was it Ejok?" he queried, and I nodded. "Ejok, the Fousals will be taking dinner in their suite. We must have at least two people to serve the meal. This is very important to meet their expectations. You can accompany me, ja?"
"Certainly. Just let me know when." He gave me a grateful squeeze of the arm, as if I were doing him a big favor. Indeed, now that I was up close and actually looking, I saw that he was still upset. Delivering food was pretty straightforward. Of course, it was always possible you'd have to run back and forth to get extra things that people requested. That hadn't happened to me before, so I hadn't thought about it until his concern was evident. "Is there anything special you want me to do? I can have something prepared." His dark, round face was set in a sort of resignation, and he shook his head in the negative.
No, but I will need you to serve out the food when we are there. Is this possible?
Of course. But wouldn't you prefer one of the waitstaff? I think that tall guy, Aiden, is on duty. He's very proper and knows his etiquette. To be forthright, I've been criticized for my manners in the past. He threw a flash of smile, but it was forced.
Yes, I thought... Well, not Aiden, but... No matter. I just would like some help.
No problem at all. Really, he was entirely preoccupied now, as if the prospect of delivering food was something to dread. It made me start down that path, too. Just how obnoxious and particular were these Fouzels? They had Duca in a growing tizzy. Granted, he might not have had more contact with them on a regular basis than someone like I normally would, but if he hated it so much, he should have quit. Assuming, of course, that he could. Indentured servitude was not exactly unknown in the galaxy, especially in the Empire. Depending upon which fiefdom you were born into, you could end up as an effective serf all your life, with precious little freedom to choose your employer or career path. That was rough to imagine, and even worse to see in action. Quite repellent, really. If the Fouzels were the type to keep slaves, they could just as likely do worse. Asking for a crew member to accompany him and to perform the actual service might have been young Duca's way to temper their reaction. If I screwed up, maybe spilled something or looked at them wrong, they could holler and scream and maybe even get me fired. But that was it. As an AIN citizen upon an AIN registered ship, they couldn't do anything serious to me. For someone who might be so much chattel, however, the punishment could be arbitrary and quite severe. It could take any form that cruel people desired, and we were in the Empire, where such things were said to happen. Of the Dorcas staff, I'd only seen Duca interact with Timot to any great extent thus far. This thing had come down outside of that chain of command, so I made a point of telling the sous chef of the intended delivery. The red-haired man was busy decking out a protein roast, so he just waved me off after a bit with the assurance that if I was following Chef Tonva's orders, he had no problem with it. As for the chef, he had gone into immediate action on their meal. It was indeed a special request, but not an unfamiliar one, apparently, as he moved like a dancer, supremely comfortable with all the steps. He was making a faux lamb meal. There was a soup course, then potatoes and other vegetables in a curry-like gravy, savory long-grain rice made with raisins, slivered almonds, and faux seafood in the shape of a squid or octopus. Earlier, Maury had made spaghetti and wheat balls for the kitchen staff, of which I'd eaten my fill. Now I was hungry all over again. Just before service to the dining room began, the rotund little cook finished the dishes he had personally prepared for the Fouzels. Duca called for the robot trolley and for me. I'd been pre-placing some garnishes on plates laid out in a long row at a prep station, and gestured to Timot, who had someone else take over. Duca stood in front of the delivery bot, straightening his uniform. He pointed to the rear of the trolley, and I took my place there. His starched smock, dark sash, and low white hat, almost like a skullcap, were in direct contrast to my uniform, which followed the French tradition. I'd managed not to spill anything on myself this shift, so after making sure all was shipshape, I stood as tall as I felt the situation required and followed the young man and the machine out into the companionway. There's something odd about a procession like this. I'd never witnessed such a thing myself, but having been in that one, I can vouch that you'll get people stepping out of the way like it was a minor holiday, watching you pass with subdued wonder and admiration. They weren't seeing us, understand. They were seeing fancy, exotic uniforms pass by with a parade float bearing an aromatic, lidded wonder. What were we delivering? To whom? I heard the questions as we walked, though at least once a couple with passive faces muttered something dismissive-sounding in Seishan, as if this was needlessly ostentatious. Opinions seemed to differ about what was or wasn't in good taste, even among the tasteless. On the one hand, I could almost understand bringing your own cook with you wherever you went. I mean, if you liked their food that much and could afford it, then why not? On the other hand, it was entirely bizarre to have your personal chef take over all responsibilities in the kitchen. What was the net gain there? The fear of non-halal food tainting the Fousal Zone would have had to have been mighty indeed to overcome all the impracticalities and costs associated with indulging such an anxiety in this way. Buying a yacht would have made it much simpler for them, I'm sure, and possibly cheaper in the long run if they traveled a lot. It seemed like a strange way to live, but there were lots of strange people in the galaxy, and some of them were fabulously wealthy. I had never actually been to the diamond-class passenger section of the ship before. That is, the one deck of such opulence it was named after Dorcas's ship class. It was laid out much like the rest of the vessel, though in keeping with the expectations of those who had any, it was replete in that one luxury aboard any ship which has no peer. It was spacious. Area in which to live and move around was at a premium on any vessel, no matter its size. Even with colony stations, which were really just space vessels written on a large scale, having enough room for your stuff and to walk without bumping into bulkheads and furniture all the time was a sign of privilege. Real estate you didn't actually need. Areas that were expressly meant to remain empty displayed real money at work. Wealth not concentrated in things, but rather in their absence. This section had its own security staff supplied by the ship. They wore sharp, light green uniforms with black piping. Specialists like the kitchen staff, the medicos, and, for whatever reason, the laundry handlers, all had their own costumes. I wasn't a fan of the green shade chosen, but the cut of the clothing was pretty nice. That piping ran down the lapels and along the collars. It followed the crease of the pants and the edge of the cuffs. Two of the guards stood at the archway as we walked in. They'd been expecting us, having received a call from the head steward. One was a woman with dark hair, and she nodded to me as we walked by. Duca just looked straight ahead, marching as stiffly as if this were a state pageant. Further in, there were individual suites that had their own protection details. One of these was a large door with a man and woman beside it in fine business suits and dark shades, reminding me of gangsters from a vid. They said nothing but watched us closely as we passed. Another similar door had a humanoid machine, indeterminately gendered, standing next to it. This thing was quite tall, 2 meters or nearly so. It had silky gray skin, if that's the word, made from some sort of nano-carbon material. It was likely bulletproof and maybe everything else proof. The machine barely had a face or other biological emulations, really just a vague notion of human features, like a person wearing a full-body silk leotard, mask included. Muscles, groin, jawline, mouth closed and sealed, nose, brows, forehead, all of it dark and silky like semi-polished stone. It didn't acknowledge us, nor even turn its head to watch. Without eyes or cameras, it obviously relied upon other sensors to experience the world, and those didn't require moving to see. Likely, it could detect motion, objects, and potential threats in all directions simultaneously, which I found irrationally unsettling. This wasn't the Fousal suite, so we walked on, and the static automaton remained such. I kept glancing over my shoulder anyway until it was around the curve of the companionway and out of sight. This hallway sported busts of unknown people in frozen blankness, sitting upon Greek-style pedestals every few meters. Elaborate cornices shaped like wood shavings or ocean waves. Paintings of fanciful stone ruins on old Terra. And actual wallpaper in swirling, patterned burgundy. For his part, Duca didn't appear to bat an eye. He didn't gawk at things the way I did. He kept his head straight and shoulders level. He really moved in a sort of slow march, and it began to feel like this was what the passengers in Diamond Class expected to see in the servants. I did my best to copy him. My enthusiasm for this career path may have been eroding, but that was something for me to contend with, not the ship and not the passengers. At the end of the Diamond Class section was a final suite with double doors. These were intricately carved and golden, all leaves and stems curved like paisleys. Two extremely large men, either of whom might have outmassed the robot down the hall, stood to the sides of the doors. They wore bright red uniforms and long coattails that extended to the backs of their knees. These coats had white piping and large black buttons that matched their dark slippers. A black sash angled down from the right shoulder to the left hip. Both had sidearms, the holsters of which were attached to the sash. These weapons would have been stunners aboard a ship of this sort, nothing else being legal, and even then only for authorized security personnel. With Dorcas bearing the flag of the Alliance, such laws had to be respected, no matter the territory. The men sported long, dark, impeccably groomed beards with florid mustaches, identical in cultivation and grooming, as if such facial hair was another aspect of the uniform. These guys cut quite a dash and were certainly big and serious enough in aspect to discourage trouble. But I confess, I began to leak a touch of the same disdain for the Diamond Class section's gaudy decorations, ridiculous doors, and over-the-top protectors as the whispering couple we'd passed on the walk over. It made me smirk, despite my inward conviction of stoicism from only a minute previous. Security guards, in my experience, rarely appreciate smiles of dubious pedigree, and these two were no exceptions. I wiped away my bemusement as soon as I realized it had been noticed, but the passive professionalism they'd been displaying up until then turned a shade darker and more mistrustful. We stopped a few meters off, and Duca said something in Seishan that my rig translated as dinner delivery. He then added a nonsense phrase which my retinals didn't catch, which may have been a password or just a greeting. They gave the linesman barely a glance, but scoured me with granite eyes. One of them asked who I was, and my translator application ran a step or two behind Duca's hasty explanation.
"He can wait out here, then,"
the man replied in that foreign tongue. Clearly for my sake, then, the cook's assistant switched to English.
"No, it takes two of us to present this meal service. It is why I brought him. The Camo, our blessed Mr. Fausel, expects it."
The translator program was still running, but injected inside another lingo the way Duca had done it, the word Camo came back with a long list of matches from a wide variety of languages, most of them old and Terran. The visual noise was getting in the way of my view, so I muttered a closeout command that shut off the program. If Duca was going to translate, it was superfluous anyway.
"What was that?"
the other guard demanded of me in the one language I did know.
"Do you mutter disrespect? Speak up, you animal!"
"Excuse me?" I responded, instantly prickly. I'd done nothing to deserve that kind of tone, and it made mine have an unwholesome edge. Duca saw where this was heading and jumped in, speaking rapidly in Seishan again. He gestured back at me and chattered in an expository manner. The young linesman was sweating bullets by this time, and his nervousness was contagious. I wondered suddenly if these men could even tell the difference between mild indignation and a real threat. Paramilitary types were infamous for mistaking those two things, and my being from a foreign nation couldn't have helped one bit. The big men listened to the small chef's assistant for a bit before the one who had insulted me stepped over.
"Raise your arms. I am going to search you."
I did as he demanded, feeling both put upon and fearful. He did a careful pat down, not just touching my sides, sleeves, and pant legs, but also carefully running his hands over the white fabric, shoulders to ankles, back and front, feeling for hidden weapons. I let him do so, mouth closed for a change, until he grabbed my jaw and prized it open. He had a ring on his middle finger with a piece of cut glass as the inset stone. He pressed this and it sprang to life, projecting a beam like a penlight. He held his massive fist before my face, and when he said to raise my tongue, I did so. For what seemed like a silly amount of time, I stood there as he gave me a dental checkup, searching for cavities, gingivitis, or dangerous devices. The potential for violence in these men was obvious by this point, and my interpretation of their fashion choices, as well as the situation in general, segued from humor to fear. They didn't look anything like a joke to me now. While I was being handled with such affection, the other guard gave the robot cart the exact same treatment. He lifted the lids on the chafing dishes and used an accompanying serving spoon to dig through the food. Chunks of succulent meat analogs, fragrant rice, sauces, hors d'oeuvres, and more of those flaky honey nut pastries that had seemed to challenge Zane. The guy then poked around the bot itself, looking here and there, and even opening its service panel on the side. I hadn't noticed before, but he held a small, flat device in one hand and glanced at it while going over everything. Eventually, my shakedown was over, as was the cart's. For good measure, the other guard held the device up at me. It didn't beep or anything, but he focused it at my eyes for a moment, then said a word I didn't understand to his partner. This guy came back with the ring light and inspected my eyes carefully, one after the other. My ocular implants were good ones, and they polarized accordingly, shearing off the worst of the dazzle. Retinals were really quite common, and while these were higher-end things than I personally had ever owned before, with features to match, they were otherwise mundane. The dour, bearded men seemed satisfied that this was the case after a moment, and the one with the device spoke quietly into his collar mic, receiving an immediate answer I couldn't hear. He took his place next to the door, while his buddy lined up behind me to follow. Duca watched this particular guy with severe apprehension, which inspired even more of it in me. I hadn't been nervous at all until we'd gotten to Diamond Class. It reinforced my baser instincts such that I was ready, very ready, to arch my back and resist all the suspicion. We were bringing them their food, for crying out loud. As a thank you, I got insults, manhandling, and the 1,000-meter stare. Duca finally drew a resigned breath, then turned back to face the door, resuming his stately posture. I did likewise, since it seemed the quickest way through this. The first man waved us forward while the doors parted with a hiss, indicating they were pressure capable. That wasn't unusual, since all cabin hatches on a passenger vessel were required to be. It was the thickness of the doors that caught my attention. 5 centimeters of solid metal, undoubtedly blast-resistant, secure as a fortress. Nothing but the best in Diamond Class. Buy your ticket now. 4 young women met us at the door. They each wore identical blue dresses, long and patterned. They had transparent masks over their faces, like the thinnest of veils, made of some light fracturing material that rippled in rainbows as they moved. The women had golden headgear, like tiaras, laden with matching beads sitting on black hair that hung poker straight to the middle of their backs. Of what I could see through the shifting colors, they each had an ethnic appearance similar to that of Chef Tonva and Duca. And they were so alike to each other in appearance, I'd have guessed they were clones if it weren't for some differences in height and build. The double doors closed silently behind us on their own. Two of the young women, however they were born, escorted us further in, while the other two scooted ahead to open yet another door. Beyond and to the left was a very large wooden chest carved in geometric shapes, busy but nice and clearly old. To the right was a tapestry showing another elaborate geometric design, this one in reds and purples. It was quite beautiful and doubtlessly expensive. It could have hung in a museum and was striking. Actually, this cabin, and I had to remind myself that that's what it actually was, seemed like an appropriate place, considering the temple-like character of the rooms. Our security escort came up close behind as we followed the lead of similar girls. From a side door, another man dressed as a guard stepped out. He was equally bearded as the others, though not quite as big, and seemed older. He wore a glittering gold earring of some size in his left lobe. The man leveled obsidian eyes at Duca, and then at me, but said nothing. The young women offered this guy polite head nods as they passed, but he kept his level gaze upon the galley staff. We arrived at even more double doors then, which opened as we all approached. Within was a smaller apartment, and our robot trolley trundled forth. Three of the not-quite-clone girls stopped to wait outside, while the first one entered ahead of us. Duca, the trolley, and I followed, while our minder stepped in behind and stood off to one side. This was a rounded, rectangular chamber with a high cove ceiling, tinted a darker shade than the gilded white of the walls and corners in the rest of the suite. Soft, curved molding that graduated from white to semi-shadow to umbra. It gave the impression of height without actually adding any. Most walls and ceilings of fancy apartments, domiciles, and offices were programmable. They could even be used as vid displays in order to simulate a sky or anything else desired. And here, they were set to some simple, unchanging, muted colors. The doors closed behind. I could feel the guards' distrusting eyes burning into the back of my head, but I was the unfamiliar element in the room, which was the likely cause. This large dining area had an abundance of potted plants, and there was a distinct and rather exotic scent of cinnamon and something else in the air. A flute played from hidden speakers, sounding far away. An elaborate tea set sat on a sideboard, steam rising from it silently. Already, the beautiful aroma in the room was mixing with those of the heavily spiced meal. A long, narrow table dominated the center of the room, and an older man dominated the table. Sitting at one end, he was lanky and stooped, though not necessarily with age. I estimated him to be biologically in his late 60s or early 70s. He had a short, snow-white beard, thin features, and narrow, dark eyes that brightened up when we came in. He wore a rich, blue dinner jacket with expressive embroidery. The jacket, or his shirt beneath, had ruffled cuffs. He wore what appeared to be an ascot, saffron yellow and shiny as silk, affixed to his throat with a glittering stick pin. On the other end of the table was a younger woman. She was short, a bit round, and had florid, jet-black hair. She wore a nose ring with a gold chain that looped up to her left ear. She enjoyed the same vaguely Asiatic aspect as the sisters, though didn't otherwise resemble them. She might have been in her mid-30s and was richly attired, implying her to be the mistress of the household. We'd been told these people were traveling with a couple of kids, but none were present. The cart had drawers filled with extra plates and cutlery, and Duca began reaching for some when the lady stopped him with a gesture.
"It's just us tonight. The children won't be dining," she said in low speak and with a gentle voice. "They are feeling ill from the transition."
That was not uncommon. Even the smoothest of star jumps can be disorienting if you're a newcomer to interstellar travel. Some kids had more resistance to that sort of thing than adults, but not all. As a teenager, my first few waking jumps had been rough ones, bad enough to make me doubt I could even work in space. Duca looked confused, even worried.
They will not be here?"
The woman just shook her head slightly, with a mild, measured smile that offered nothing, obviously designed for the hirelings.
"But surely they came aboard with you?"
"Of course. We'll call for something later if they're hungry."
She then gestured for us to proceed, a languid motion with her fingers, elegant and sure. Duca stood there, fully flummoxed.
"Hey, it's all good. Let's just do this," I whispered, leaning in.
He nodded then and proceeded with a start. I lifted the silver lid to the main dish, setting it upon a folding tray built into the side of the robot. The younger man fumbled with the smaller lids for the side dishes. His nerves had not abated. Did he have reason to fear them? They seemed nice enough. Indeed, Mr. Fousel kept his smile up. It was easy, even warm. He made a happy-sounding comment in Seishan, and I caught Chef Tonva's name. The linesman gestured to me to prepare some bowls, then bowed deeply to his master. I took two out from the holder on the cart and tried to set them to one side of the soup, but there was no room. The robot's upper surface was covered in a soft, thick, rubberized pad. Anything placed on it sank in somewhat, preventing it from sliding around as the machine rolled through the ship. The pad was removable and easy to wash, but it had a habit of sticking to bare metal. This was normally no big deal, but it could be a pain when that metal was a large tureen filled with scalding hot soup that needed shifting, just so some stupid little bowls could be set down next to it. Minor frustrations can be the most distracting. I was busy with this, in other words, and the guard was busy watching me, which is why neither of us noticed that Duca had come up from his respectful bow with a palm pistol. It had a squeeze-handle trigger, and he just pointed it at that dark-bearded guy so intent upon the suspicious alliancer in the room. The big man folded up against the wall with a thump and a grunt that was louder than the dull report of the weapon itself. One muted pop, and the only armed obstacle in the room was down. The linesman then turned back to Mr. Fousel, all this happening so quickly it had yet to register on him or anyone else. The old man was still smiling, in fact, when Duca shot him in the head. You have been listening to All He Surveys, Volume 1, a Star Drifter novel written and read by David Collins Rivera. This story is copyright 2022 by David Collins Rivera and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 international license. Feel free to use it for any purpose, even commercial, and I encourage you to do so. The Star Drifter theme is a piece called Icor by Trunks and can be found on SoundCloud.com. The All He Surveys theme is a piece called Blossom by Edward Malov and is licensed through TribeOfNoise.com. This story is a work of fiction and is not based upon nor meant to portray any person, living or dead, nor any particular place or situation. Any similarities to such are purely coincidental. You can contact me at lostinbronx@gmail.com. That's LOSTNBRONX at Gmail. You can also check out my site, davidcollinsrivera.com, where you'll find everything Star Drifter, including more audio novels and stories, the Star Drifter tabletop role-playing game, podcasts, newsletters, and more. Stop by, won't you, and drop me a line. Thank you for listening. Take care.